Good morning. I trust you all are doing well. It is a privilege to be here. I'm grateful for Jeff and for the elders for the opportunity to speak. If you would, bow with me in prayer. But before that, please turn to the book of Esther. We'll be there this morning. And it'd be good if you could follow along with me if you're able to do so. Father, we thank you for today. For the unseen ways in which you are moving now. Father, my prayer is for those who are suffering a crisis of faith now, and for those who will suffer a crisis of faith, that we can take comfort in your plan. Take comfort in your promises. Father, may it be this morning that you use the book of Esther in your word, which has preserved for us those ancient words which are ever true. May you use those words to encourage, to convict, to edify, and may your spirit do the work that I cannot do. In Jesus' name, amen. I want to set the stage before we begin, because Esther is a very interesting book, and that was a very lengthy reading, but it captures something important. It captures the people of God in the middle of a crisis, and the text ends where they are facing the crisis and they are bewildered. Now, we can look forward, and we know what the book of Esther is about. The book of Esther is about the celebration of the Feast of Purim, where God has brought about a reversal of the situation of the people. They were threatened with annihilation. God brought about a reversal. And the Feast of Purim is a result of that and a commemoration for all generations about what God has done. It's a festal ideology. It's a reason for why the Jews continue to celebrate the Feast of Purim, celebrating what God has done in the reversal, in the crisis in which their lives were threatened. Chapter 9 says this, and here's the reason for the book of Esther. Mordecai recorded these events, and he sent letters to all the Jews throughout the provinces of King Xerxes, near and far, to have them celebrate annually the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar. Now, we just heard in the reading that Haman had issued a decree with the king's permission that the Jews would be destroyed on these 2 days. But when we look forward at the end, at the other side of the crisis, we see what God has done. And now the very days in which the Jews were said to have been destroyed, God brought about a reversal when he transformed their mourning, he transformed their grief into joy. So Mordecai writes and has them celebrate annually, verse 21, the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar, as the time when the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month when their sorrow was turned into joy, and their mourning into a day of celebration. He wrote them to observe the days as days of feasting and joy and giving presents of food to one another and gifts to the poor. And here comes why the feast is called Purim. So the Jews, verse 23 says, agreed to continue the celebration they had begun, doing what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them and had cast the poor, that is, the lot, for their ruin and destruction. But when the plot came to the king's attention, he issued written orders that the evil scheme Haman had devised against the Jews should come back onto his own head and that he and his son should be impaled on poles. Therefore, these days were called Purim, from the word poor. There's something radically important about this text because it gives us encouragement. It shows us, the book of Esther shows us what God can do in a crisis. when powers are often out of control and things are unexpected and happening that we cannot control, it shows that God can bring about a reversal. And this is what the book of Esther is about. It's the background of why the Jews continue to this day to celebrate the Feast of Purim. Now, I want to catch us up to chapter 2, and then we'll proceed from there. So I want to bear with me. I want to give a little historical background. When is the story of Esther written? It's written a long time ago, in the 5th century B.C., in the 470s. I added that together because I looked up how to find out how long that was. It's about 2,500 years ago. You'll note that the story starts out not in Jerusalem, not in the homeland of God's people, but in the Persian Empire. It's 800 miles away from Jerusalem. Why is there a story about God's people in another land? I'll tell you how they got there. God's people were unfaithful. They had sinned, and God brought about on them the curses that he had promised for their unfaithfulness. Another nation, the Babylonians, came in and conquered them. They destroyed the temple. The hope of God's presence is gone. The people are forcibly carried off, but a remnant is preserved. They spend about 70 years in captivity, from 586 to 539. Then Cyrus conquers the Babylonians, and he sends some of the Jews that still remain, back to the land of Jerusalem. So they go the 800 miles back to Jerusalem. But some of the people decided to stay behind in the Persian Empire. And this is where we get to the book of Esther. For these Jews that are ripped out of their homeland and that are living under the power of King Xerxes, who's also called King Ahasuerus. And so the setting for Esther is 800 miles from Jerusalem. I'll tell you something about King Xerxes. We know from secular history outside of the Bible by Herodotus, this is how he describes King Xerxes: an impatient, hot-tempered monarch with a wandering eye for women. That's outside of Scripture, and it harmonizes quite well with what we know of King Xerxes from the book of Esther. An impatient, hot-tempered monarch with a wandering eye for women. He likes to show off his wealth. He's a powerful man, but he often uses his power in unpredictable ways. And we see that in chapter 1. King Xerxes is married to Queen Vashti. He's doing what he does best, showing off his land, showing off his palace, showing off his royal cups, giving a feast for 6 months. And he decides that he wants to show off Queen Vashti to everyone, to all of the people, so he can show off her beauty. Queen Vashti refuses to come. King Xerxes does not like this. That's disrespectful to him in front of his dinner guest. He's furious. So what does he do? He banishes Queen Vashti, and he follows the advice of the wise men that say, you know what? If our wives get to know what Queen Vashti did, they're not going to obey us either. So what you need to do is you need to issue a royal decree for all of the women in all of the 127 provinces so that they are obedient to their husbands at home. These are the kinds of things that King Xerxes does. He takes advice, but even the circle of people that are advising him often don't give him wise advice, and they're able to manipulate the king. Now in chapter 2, King Xerxes recognizes that he needs a new queen. So he follows advice again of his close advisors, and they say, you know what? There's a lot of beautiful women scattered throughout the Persian Empire. Why don't you gather them all together? You can bring them in to the palace, and you can choose whoever you like the best. Now, these women are carried off against their will. One of them just happens to be a Jewess, orphaned, her parents have died, raised by her cousin Mordecai. She is among the beautiful virgins that are taken to the palace of the king, forcibly taken there against their will. But she keeps her nationality a secret. The text says that two times. Now there's a huge crisis in the text. And the background of how Xerxes responds and how he uses his power sets us up. And so here's what I want to ask you. God's people are living in another land, and the threat is annihilation. The king has given his approval, his okay. Without investigating, he just takes Haman at his word. These people are not good for you. They're not obeying your laws. The king doesn't investigate it. The king gives authority to Haman to carry out this plan. And this is the crisis. This is the threat, the crisis that God's people are facing. Their very existence is threatened. And so let me ask you, in moments where your faith is threatened, in moments where you go through a crisis, where do you go? Where do you turn? You probably turn to God. Right? We're believers, we turn to God. But what do you do when God just can't be seen, where he seems far away, where he seems hidden? What do you do in a crisis of faith when God just can't be detected? As much as you cry, you can't find him. As much as you pray, he doesn't seem to be there. What do you do in those kind of situations? The book of Esther helps us, I think, here. Try searching for the word God in the book of Esther. 167 verses, 10 chapters. No God. King Xerxes is mentioned 190 times. Mordecai is mentioned a bunch of times. Haman is mentioned. Esther is mentioned. Vashti is mentioned. The Jews are mentioned. But there is no mention of God, and these people are in a crisis. What do you do? This is why some people don't like the book of Esther over the years, because there's no mention of God. It's too secular. Someone in the 16th century wanted to get it out of the canon, wanted to get rid of the book of Esther because he said it Judaizes too much and it's too secular. There's no mention of God. There's no mention of prayer. There's no mention of the temple. There's no mention really of Jerusalem. There's no mention of the law. Where is God in this text? But I don't know, I think I kind of like the fact that God is not explicitly mentioned in this text. Because isn't it the case that oftentimes we don't fully realize how and where God is working in a crisis until after the crisis is over with? Philip Yancey, I think, said something like this. He said, "Faith is believing in advance what only makes sense in reverse." And I know that it's true of my life, and I bet it's true of yours too in a crisis. Through the tears, through the prayers, yes, a crisis is there where God seems absent, but you have a promise and a plan from God, but those two are clashing. And it's only after you have traveled through the fire and you've cried and you've wondered where God is, it's only afterward that you can look back and interpret and see, oh, that door was closed because of this, and God sent these people here at just the right time, and God closed this door, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened. And you can't see it sometimes while you're in the middle of a crisis, but after you go through it and you pass through it, you turn around and you look back and you see God all over the place. That's how the book of Esther is. God is not absent. He's just working behind the scenes. And there's this unseen hand with a master plan. What is that plan? What is that plan? That plan stretches way back to Genesis, and it goes way after the book of Esther. Genesis 3. What did the Lord say to Adam? He put a curse upon the serpent. He cursed the ground, pain for the woman. But he said one day, in chapter 3, verse 12, one day there will come one who will stomp on the head and destroy the serpent that had tried to destroy his creation. That plan becomes more explicit in Genesis chapter 12. God calls Abram and he gives them a fourfold blessing. He says, leave your people and I will bless you. I will make your name great. And what does he say? Here is the promise that accompanies the plan. Through you, through your offspring, all nations will be blessed. That plan was always there. It had always been there. And when God seems absent, you have to trust in the promises of his plan. His plan always stays the same. And his plan is to preserve a people so that he can send the Messiah so that we can be saved. And God has preserved his people throughout history. Sometimes it was miraculous. Sometimes in the Exodus, you look at the plagues, you look at the parting of the water. God has a plan and a promise to preserve his people. The Egyptians cannot destroy them because God had promised. He gave a promise to Adam, he gave a promise to Abraham. I will not allow my people to perish. God's people needed to be punished. He brought in another nation. We talked about the exile as the historical backdrop to this. Forcibly carried off. But God can't destroy them all, because if he destroys them all, then the Messiah won't come. And if the Messiah won't come, we don't have salvation. So all through this, this is true in the book of Esther too. God's plan is to preserve his people. It is a promise. And this is not something new that the people of Esther just found out. It goes way back to Adam. And so what I want to tell you is that when God seems absent in your life, when God seems like he is far away, there's an unseen hand with a master plan. That plan is accompanied by a promise to send the Messiah. And God is faithful to his promises. He has declared that he will not allow his people to be annihilated. Because if his people are annihilated, there's no hope for us. So this is why Esther is so important. Because it is evidence that God is still faithful to his promises. And it continues throughout the history of the Jewish people. Check out the genealogy of Matthew. It starts off a record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of Abraham, the son of David. Abraham, the father of Isaac. Isaac, the father of Jacob. God is still working. Jacob, the father of Judah. Judah, the father of Perez. Perez, the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram. Ram, the father of Amminadab. God is still working. On and on it goes through the Babylonian exile all the way down to the Christ. And so what we have is the evidence that God has brought his promises. He will preserve his people, and the Christ is born. Before Esther, after Esther, the promise that God has set in motion is his plan to preserve his people. And that ought to bring us some comfort. So when God seems absent in your life, trust in the promises of the plan that has not failed and cannot fail. By the way, this is point number two, so if you want to take this down, God's plan is being carried out even if things don't happen the way you think they should. Why is that important? Because if you turn on the TV, sometimes you'll hear this health and wealth preaching kind of stuff that God always wants to bless you. You sow the seed and God is going to bless you. But what is that going to do for me when I go through a valley or when I go through a crisis? I don't need health and wealth then. I need a God with an unseen hand with a master plan. And the comforting and securing thing about God's plan is that it can handle unexpected surprises. And when things don't turn out the way you think they should, God's plan is still being carried out. And why is that comforting? Because when we are in a situation in which things are beyond our control, and we're dealing with sinful people that make all kind of decisions, we may experience injustice, we may experience suffering, but God's plan still works in spite of it. And so what I'm hoping to do with this point here, this point that says God's plan is being carried out even when things don't happen the way you think they should, is to help our faith be strengthened so that when unexpected things like a crisis and a COVID and whatever God has, whatever is going to happen to you that you may not know about and it may not turn out the way you wanted it to, that you can trust that God is there and he's working out his plan. And you need to know that. I want you to be strengthened. Let me illustrate it for you. Look in the text. Chapter 2, verses 21 to 23. And as you're reading this, I want you to be thinking through your expectations of what should happen. What should happen to Mordecai because of what he's done. During the time Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, that just means he was basically some kind of official at the king's gate. Now, it just so happened that Mordecai is there. It just so happened that he's related to Esther, but the king doesn't know that yet. Let's keep that in mind. But Mordecai is there, and it just so happens that he overhears these two people, Bigthana and Teresh, that want to assassinate the king. This comes to the attention of Mordecai. He tells Queen Esther, who it would have never probably gotten to the king unless Mordecai was related to Queen Esther. Queen Esther tells the king. The king investigates it and finds out that the plan is true. The two guys that were planning to assassinate the king or put to death and impaled. And then verse 23. And when the report was investigated and found to be true, the two officials were impaled on poles. All this was recorded in the book of the annals in the presence of the king. Now, we know also from secular history that something like this is supposed to be rewarded immediately. He's just saved the king's life. And what you're expecting, what I was expecting at least, what were you expecting? You would expect chapter 3 to begin and say that the king rewarded Mordecai for saving his life. That's what you expect. But look what happens. After these events, years have gone by, King Xerxes honored Haman, son of Hammedatha. Oh, no. And not only is he Haman, he's an Agagite. We'll get there later. Elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than that of all the other nobles. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. Now, what you expect, this is not fair. It appears to be not fair. This situation is not fair. If I'm Mordecai, I wonder what he thought about this. Did he just kind of blow it off? Did he not care? Was he upset about it? Did he cry out to God about it? One thing I do know, though, is that our perception, our perspective, often like Mordecai, is often limited. And if we peek forward to chapter 6, we can kind of get the whole picture. But before we go there, look at verse 23. Of chapter 2, and when the report was investigated and found to be true, the two officials were impaled on poles. Now, this is important. The king has overlooked. I don't know if he's forgotten about it. We're not told why Mordecai is not rewarded, but he's not. He should be, but he's not. This is not fair. Verse 23 records something that seems to be insignificant. All this was recorded in the book of the annals in the presence of the king. Now, if you're looking at that and you don't know the rest of the story, you're thinking, that's not very important. Okay, it was recorded. It was recorded in the book of the Kings, but Mordecai wasn't rewarded. That is not fair. That is my perspective. It may not have been Mordecai's, but the expectation is that fairness, justice, warrants that Mordecai should be rewarded, but he's not. He's overlooked for years. And it may be that an unexpected circumstance caused by someone else, you might be overlooked, you might have to suffer something that you don't expect, that falls to you. And what will you do in those circumstances? We need to see that God has another perspective. Turn to chapter 6 and we can find out what happens. Chapter 6, verses 1 to 3. Another seeming insignificant event. That night the king could not sleep. Put those two together. It was recorded. What Mordecai had done was recorded 5 years ago, chapter 6, verse 1, the king can't sleep. Who cares? That doesn't seem, those two things taken apart don't seem to be very significant. But look what happens. Whenever you can't sleep, the king evidently loves to have the records read. That night the king could not sleep, so he ordered the book of the Chronicles, the record of his reign, to be brought in and read to him. It was found recorded there. Now, 5 years have gone by, and the king can't sleep, and so now the records are read. And it was found recorded there that Mordecai had exposed Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, who had conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. What honor, says the king, and recognition has Mordecai received for this, the king asks. Nothing has been done for him, his attendants answered. And this sets a plan in motion to preserve God's people. Here's the thing here. If the king had awarded Mordecai immediately, then this might not have happened. God used the forgetfulness of a king who had no idea that Mordecai and Esther were related, and it just so happened that Esther was selected to be queen because she pleased the king the most. And it just so happens that she's related to Mordecai. And it just so happened that Mordecai is sitting at the king's gate. And it just so happens that he tells it to Esther and Esther tells it to the king. And it just so happens that the king forgot. But it just so happens that it was recorded. And then 5 years go by and all of a sudden the king remembers, and he remembers because he can't sleep. Now, you take just one of those things, it doesn't sound very significant. But once you put all of those things together, there's too many coincidences there to deny that God is not working in that. And Mordecai could have said, I want my honor, I want my glory. But God said, I've got to preserve my people. And if it means that the king is going to forget about you now so that you can be honored later for my plan to preserve my people, then that's what's most important. The thing about it is, we often can't see that in the middle of a crisis. But you see what was happening here. God didn't just work in the crisis. He was already orchestrating things before. He put Esther there. He put Mordecai there. He brought it to the king's attention. God is working through that whole process to preserve his people. And so my question for you is this. Are you willing to suffer injustice? Because God can use it as a part of his plan to save someone? Are you willing to be overlooked for years? Are you willing to be trampled on, to suffer injustice? If God calls you to do so as a part of his plan, it's not that he's delighting in it, but it's that he's using it. And the beautiful thing about that is these people have no idea. But the beauty of Scripture is that when people intend stuff for evil, God uses what they do for good. He did it for Joseph. He did it in the Exodus, and he does it in the cross. What you intended for evil, God intended for good, to bring about the saving of many lives. And what that tells me is that I can trust God in the middle of a crisis, not knowing exactly how he's going to work, but trusting in his plan. And if he can use me as a part of that plan, then I need to be willing to suffer unjust treatment. I need to be willing to bear up if God lets me live long enough to be like my dad, who had to go through cancer. I hated the anguish that it caused him. I'm sure he wasn't expecting it. But my dad is a counselor. And now, having gone through that process, he's able to minister to Christians because of the faith that he bore in the midst. Yes, he cried about it. Oh, I was terrified by it. And that's unexpected. And the thing about it is, you can't know all of the experiences because we're dealing with sinful people in the world, and you can't know. But one thing you can know is that despite those injustices, despite those sufferings, in the middle of the valley, God is not absent. He may be unseen, but you discern him by the eyes of faith, and you walk through suffering, and one day, and it may not be this side of eternity, it may not be to the other side of eternity, that you find out all the reasons, but if you know that you can trust God to work some good from the suffering that other people inflict on you, then that should motivate us. That should bring us some comfort. And that should help us get through things. The last thing I want to leave you with is this. There is no evil that can stop the fulfillment of God's plan. There is no evil. I don't care how powerful the evil is. There's some pretty powerful evil in this text. There's some pretty powerful evil in the world right now, where people are abusing their power. Do you see the abuse of power in the text? Because one man will not bow down, Another man not only wants to destroy this man, but he wants to annihilate all of the Jews. Now that's some evil. That is some kind of evil. But you see how this threat clashes with the plan that God had set in motion back in the garden to Abraham and on down the line that he would preserve his people. So who is this Haman guy that thinks that he can annihilate God's people? Yes, he may be second in command. He has all the power. He controls the people, but he's under God. And anything that he tries to do to thwart God's promises cannot come to pass. It just can't happen. And that encourages us, not only for unexpected moments, but also when we look on the news and we turn it on and we see all of the chaos that is going on. You want to see abuse of power? Go to Germany and attempt to exterminate and annihilate all the Jews. You know what brought them comfort? The book of Esther. Because it says that they cannot be exterminated. And here they are. They are still a people. They still exist despite all odds, despite every attempt to get rid of them. They continue to exist. And the book of Esther was outlawed in concentration camps, but they wrote it out by memory because it's evidence that God preserves his people in the face of a crisis. And let me share this with you. You don't get to feasting and joy without the mourning and the grief. There is no Purim. There is no reversal without going through the process of a crisis. It is inescapable. You must go through things sometime, and then it turns to joy. And then it turns to, you've turned my joy, you've turned my mourning into dancing. But here it is again, there is no evil that can stop the fulfillment of God's plan. Now I want to bring out sharply the importance of the word Agagite. After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. Now, the original readers of that text would have immediately thought of the Amalekites. And we know that this is important. Look at how Haman is referred to in other places. Chapter 3, verse 1, Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. Chapter 3 and verse 10, Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. Chapter 8, verse 1, Haman, the enemy of the Jews. Chapter 8, verse 5, Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. Chapter 9, verse 10, Haman, son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. Chapter 9, verse 24, Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. When the Jews heard Agagite, they would think Amalekites. The Amalekites were people that ever since God's people came into existence, they attacked them without warning, unprovoked. They attacked God's people. You could read about them in 1 Samuel 15, in Deuteronomy 25, and Exodus 17. Go back and read about them. But what you need to know is that they are a constant threat to God's people. And God said you need to blot them out. And in 1 Samuel chapter 15, Saul failed to do that. And they evidently continue on, or the author of Esther is associating Haman with the Agagites. They are this persistent source of evil that is trying to get rid of God's people. And I think that really captures well what Satan tries to do to each and every one of us every day. I think that Haman embodies what Satan attempts to do for us. He not only wants to destroy Christ, he wants to destroy Christ's church. And he's tried to do so through the centuries. He's tried to persecute the church, even when it was small, but the church grew. He tried to stamp out God's people at various points in time, but he couldn't. He cannot do it because he is not strong enough to do what God does not allow him to do. He cannot get rid of God's people. And look at the text. One man trying to get rid of an entire nation. Think back to the garden and the sin of Adam. One man's sin leads to the condemnation of the many. And that's the larger crisis of sin that I think is apparent in the text. Yes, we all deserve just what the Jews were threatened with in this text. Death, annihilation, because of our sins and because of our self-centeredness And because of our rebellion, we deserve doom. We deserve condemnation. That is the crisis for us. But there is only one man that can save the nation. And that one man is the second Adam, who reverses what the first Adam had done. And in the cross, there is this divine reversal of what Satan has tried to do by stamping out the Messiah, but he still cannot do it. So I want to leave you with this. In times where God seems absent, trust in his plan. Know, without a shadow of a doubt, that God's plan is being carried out, even if, even when, things don't turn out the way you expect them to. Have some forward-looking eyes in moments like that, that trust that one day you'll be able to look back and see this string of coincidences, so that when God seemed like he was absent at the time, you look back and see his hand all over the place, preserving you. And thirdly, know this, there is no evil that can stop the fulfillment of God's plan. Now, we've seen evil. We've seen it, when I mentioned with the Holocaust, we've seen it. We look back upon the atrocities of slavery. We saw it then. We saw it in the Soviet Union and the communist regime, which almost stamped out the Orthodox Church. We saw it. We saw it. We saw it. We saw it. And you know what? I can change it to the present tense, and I can say we see it. We see it when a cop can put his knee on the neck of a man that is handcuffed and crying out that he can't breathe. That's an abuse of power. We see it when men with money take advantage of women and commit actions of sexual assault. We see it in marriages in which a man may be physically stronger than a woman and he physically abuses her. We see it in schools where a bully can get into the mind of a young girl and convince her to hate herself and be depressed and want to take her life. We see abuse of power, and that abuse of power comes from sin. And all of us know what it's like to be under the slavery of sin. And the solution, the answer to the problems in the world is not going to come by just little quick fixes. It's going to come by a divine reversal when people submit to the power of God and they relinquish control to him. And so if you're sitting here this morning and you're going through a crisis, I want you to have the eyes to be able to look forward, to trust in God's plan, to see him working there with the eyes of faith, to be able to look back and see his hand, and to know that no amount of evil is able to thwart the plan of God. I also want to speak a word perhaps to those who are watching this message and are under right now the power of sin. They know the control of it. They feel the guilt of it. They can't escape it. What you need to do is to admit that you're powerless, and to come to the one man that has taken your sin, my sin, upon himself on the tree, and by his wounds we are healed. You need to come and you need to surrender to him and give your life to him. If there was a song that I think captures what Purim is all about, it would be this. Your light broke through my night, restored exceeding joy. Your grace fell like the rain and made this desert live. You have turned my mourning into dancing. You have turned my sorrow into joy. Your hand lifted me up. I stand on higher ground. Your praise rose in my heart and made this valley sing. You have turned my mourning into dancing. You have turned my sorrow into joy. You have turned my sorrow into dancing. You have turned my sorrow into joy. And this, my brothers and sisters, is the only way in which we overcome.